Thanks so much for joining us. It's a pleasure now to welcome James Stone. He is founder and CEO of the Plymouth Rock Group of Insurance Companies, former chairman of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, former insurance commissioner for Massachusetts, and he is also a PhD in economics from Harvard University, and the author of a new book, Five Easy Theses, Common Sense Solutions to America's Greatest Economic Challenges, Five Easy Theses by James Stone. Mr. Stone, thank you so much for joining us today.
I'm glad to be with you.
Okay. Why did you first come up with the idea to write on Five Easy Theses?
Well, you know, in some sense, it ties together all of my previous careers. I taught economics, and I was in government for 8 years, and then I ran a business in the financial sector, and I had strong feelings about questions that needed to be addressed but were not being addressed very well or specifically by our political process today. I tried very hard when I was in Washington, for example, to convince people that massively leveraged derivatives would be a threat. Well, I didn't convince people, but I'm trying again.
Let's run through the five theses. First off, fiscal balance, inequality, education, health care, and financial sector reform. Jim, I hate to tell you this, but these are not easy topics.
Well, you could say the title is a little bit facetious. I don't mean to say that there's an easy political path to the answers to any of these questions. What I mean to say is that they have logical answers. We can keep the country on a very strong course if we have the political courage to address these things, because I think both parties could agree on where we ought to go on all five of these things if they follow the logic.
Well, certainly you've identified some problems. Let's run through these and see if we can also get to some of those solutions as well. Fiscal balance, I think this is something that concerns a lot of people. One of the big things is we're concerned about spending in government, and nobody wants to see wasteful spending. At the same time, we have a couple of big programs that nobody seems to want to touch. The third rail, if you will, Social Security, also Medicare, which at some point or another look like they will eventually run out of money unless something's done.
So my argument is that we don't know whether it's okay to run a moderate deficit or to run a deficit when things are tough and then a surplus when things are well. The economic theory on that's pretty weak, but I think that great nations in general do run some degree of deficit. But we seem to run a deficit all the time, and it's getting too big, and we're wasting what we run up the deficit for. We're wasting the money, and we can fix that. And the first thing we ought to do is something to be done in the short run before we even get to Social Security and Medicare, which I agree are the big problems in the long run. But in the short run, we don't need to have the so-called tax expenditures we have now. Congress scrutinizes appropriations. People yell about whether money is well spent. But appropriations aren't where the biggest problem is. It's on the tax side. And the best example of that, and what I try to argue in the book, is the deductions for interest. These cost the government more than the entire amount of the deficit. If we didn't have the deductions for interest, we wouldn't have a deficit at all. And what do we get for it? Well, we have the home mortgage deduction on the personal side, but the home mortgage deduction is not useful because it's not going to be enjoyed by the bottom third of the population, the people who need the most help, because they're renters. It's not going to be enjoyed by the next third because they don't itemize deductions, and you don't get it if you don't itemize. So it's only enjoyed by the top third of the population, and even there, it's enjoyed in proportion to how big a house you have. So it's regressive in that category. It doesn't raise the percentage of people who own homes, which, incidentally, the Wall Street Journal reported just fell to a new 50-year low.
Mm-hmm.
So waste of something like $100 billion a year. The corporate one is worse, because there we're subsidizing corporate takeovers and highly leveraged balance sheets. I don't resent a corporation deciding to borrow money, but there's no reason for you and me to be subsidizing their borrowing money.
Valid point. Any chance that any of that's going to change?
Well, as I say, the reason I picked that title for the book, Five Easy Theses, are that these are easy logically, but they're very tough politically. And frankly, I don't see either of the major party candidates or any leader in Congress taking a rational look at the interest deductions.
Now,
they're popular, but they don't make sense.
And let's switch over to Social Security.
Okay.
When Social Security first came about, we had really a lot of workers were paying into the system and paying for the benefits of Social Security recipients. Now we have fewer workers paying those benefits, and there's a concern that over the next 20-some-odd years or so, we're going to see some drastic cuts unless something changes. What's your proposal?
Yeah, well, you've got the problem exactly right. There were over a dozen people working for everyone they had to support in the beginning, and that ratio is moving down towards 2-to-1. And the ratio gets worse as people live longer, and they're going to live longer. The average person lived into their 60s when Social Security was created and they set the retirement age. Now the average person lives over to about 80, and soon I think it's going to be 90 because we're going to make progress, further progress on cancer and other health issues. And so we have to change the eligibility age. It just has to go up. Nobody wants to do that. And that's why it takes a lot of political courage.
But of course, there's some jobs, some people who really working past age 62 is going to be a really tough thing for them.
Mm-hmm. And I have no objection at all to saying that people who have dangerous jobs, people who have health problems that have come from their jobs, that you can have exceptions, but you don't want to do for everybody what is necessary or fair for a small number of people who have a bad situation and need our help.
What about raising
everybody? It's too expensive.
What about just raising or eliminating the cap on the payroll tax?
Well, I'm not opposed to raising the cap on the payroll tax, but you'd have to pretty much eliminate it altogether to cover the Social Security deficit. And if people live into their 90s, even that won't work. And you then get rid of the last bit of Social Security as insurance as opposed to tax. So I'd like to see some combination of raising that cap and raising the eligibility age over time. And you want to start soon, because if you wait till the last minute, then you have a crisis. It's like, you know, driving your car towards a wall. And it's a lot better if you brake early than if you brake late.
Particularly if you break too late.
Yes.
Next up, inequality. And this may be one of the biggest issues that the country faces. Because if we don't get this right, the others are going to fall by the wayside. And we really do have enormous inequality in this country. I mean, I know there's this old thing of work hard and you can make it in America. That's the idea. The reality is really quite different, though.
So you're absolutely right, and I think you and I sound like we're in complete agreement on the importance of this. People talk a lot about angry voters in this campaign season, and they ought to. The voters ought to be angry, because in the last 40 years, the median income, median family income in the United States has not increased at all. Which means that during this 40-year period, the United States, which has produced more wealth than any other country in the history of the world in a 40-year period, produced all that wealth and gave none of it to the average family and all of it to people at the top. There's something fundamentally wrong with that, and it leads to really bad outcomes, both politically and economically. Ultimately, you get, you know, to only the king has the money, and then you have the dark ages, 1,000 years of stagnation.
And yeah, and we know what happens when the king says, well, let the poor masses eat cake.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so...
So you get a revolution in that most extreme case.
And we've already seen a little of that. We've already seen a little of that, whether it be the Tea Party on one side or Occupy Wall Street on the other.
Yeah, or maybe even some of the candidates.
Mm-hmm.
You get people who appeal because they say, I'm the man on horseback that can solve all this. And, you know, if you're angry, vote for me because I'm a strong figure. That's a very dangerous trend in politics.
So there are a couple of things that we have to look at when it comes to inequality. One would be generational wealth. The other, corporate wealth.
Yep. And I agree on both of those. With respect to generational wealth, the mistake that I think we make is that we allow tremendous amounts of wealth to be accumulated by a small number of people and then passed on at death with virtually no taxes. You know, it's become very fashionable today to attack the estate tax and to talk about it as the death tax and say we ought to get rid of it. It's the fairest tax we've got. And you can have almost $11 million worth of wealth to pass on without paying any now. There's no reason to eviscerate it beyond that. There's no reason to get rid of the estate tax. It just isn't a good thing to get rid of when you're talking about $100 million and billion-dollar fortunes. Mm. That ought to be taxed, but I believe we ought to go further and tax the accumulation along the way. Tax unrealized gains, because that's where the money is.
But unrealized gains aren't realized. They're just a fiction until they're realized, aren't they?
Oh, I don't think they're a fiction. It's certainly where the wealth of all the wealthy people that I know resides. And so I hardly would call them a fiction. Now, you can say that you tax them based on performance over many years. There are many ways to do it such that it's fair. But if you ignore them, then you're ignoring the principal source of accretion of wealth, which is really the way we ought to define income.
We've also forgotten the whole idea of antitrust, haven't we?
Yes, we have. That's on the corporate side. And I think, you know, the Teddy Roosevelts of the world would be ashamed of us now for thinking that it's perfectly okay for a large company to buy another large competitor and that somehow that's going to make the world better. It's probably going to make it worse, particularly if corporations are allowed to participate in politics.
There's an interesting point there. Hang on just a moment. We will continue the conversation with Jim Stone. James Stone, the author of 5 Easy Theses. More in a moment. Money Radio, thanks so much for joining us today. We are talking with James Stone. He is the author of a new book, 5 Easy Theses, Common Sense Solutions to America's Greatest Economic Challenges. We've talked about fiscal balance. We've talked about inequality. There's quite a bit more that we could talk about when it comes to inequality. Briefly, though, you mentioned about corporate wealth and antitrust. It just seems like we're not dealing with that issue at all. Why don't we just, for example, have international reporting, and if a company wants to move offshore, we impose the death tax on them?
Well, remember I said the solutions to these things are easy logically. They're very difficult politically, and as soon as you need a treaty between nations to do it, you run into more political difficulties.
Thomas Piketty suggested a universal international uniform wealth tax.
And if that could happen, it would be a very constructive thing. But even he acknowledges it's not so likely to happen.
Education. Americans like to think that we have the best education system in the world. We don't.
Well, we certainly don't. I do think we probably have the best graduate school system and a terrific college system at the elite level. After that, our regular college system for most people and our high school system, elementary school system, are at best average by world standards. That's what all the tests show. And the system is basically failing people now because two-thirds of everybody, 70%, are not going to get a college degree. We need to give those people occupational and vocational training, and we don't do that. Other nations do. We don't. And then if you do go to college, you end up with so much debt that you're crippled or you drop out. So we need to deal with both the cost of college and the path for those who are not going to college.
You write in the book about a universal national service. College students could pay for their education by serving their country maybe a year or two. That also serves a dual purpose. That would be a great way to fix up infrastructure.
Absolutely. So that's the solution that I think is best. It provides the vocational training if you set it up right. It helps rebuild the infrastructure, and it helps pay for college. It's a very good solution, and patriotic as well.
Healthcare, we pay roughly twice as much as most advanced economies. We don't get the results for it, though. The U.S. ranks, what, about 34th on the list of nations?
Yeah, something like that. We aren't better in any of the things that you would use to measure. We're not better than the average well-developed country in life expectancy, infant mortality, healthy lifespan, obesity, morbidity statistics, you name it. We're not better. We spend over $1.3 trillion dollars a year more than we would if we spent same percentage GNP as everybody else, and we get nothing for it. Why? Because we waste a lot of money on too much diagnostic testing, marketing and administration costs that nobody else has, pharmaceutical prices, which we seem to be trying to push up rather than down, and the toughest issue, end-of-life care.
Most of the other countries that are doing this well and with better results for less use a single-payer, single-regulator, universal healthcare kind of a system.
Well, they all use different systems, but all of them have something along those lines, some central authority. And I think we do need a central overseer. Not a central provider, but a central overseer of the system to deal with each of those issues that I just talked about. And incidentally, the end-of-life issue, I said, is the most difficult. The end-of-life issue, at least a start would be to get people, while they are still healthy, to tell us how much end-of-life care they want and then obey it, rather than try to save everybody in a respirator very expensively at the end of life, even those who don't want it.
Mm-hmm. Next up, financial sector reform. Now, you worked in the CFTC, the Commodities Futures Trading Commission. You've looked at derivatives. We've seen what happened when we get this wrong. It was the crash of 2008. The big banks failed us. The big banks proved too big to fail and too big to jail. And that's
and too big to manage.
And too big to manage. The big bankers tend to argue that we can't afford to cut them up. But they're the only ones who seem to make that argument. The rest of the world seems to be okay with the idea of, well, why couldn't a smaller bank do the job?
And I think smaller banks can do the job because they can work in groups when they need to, when you need a bigger amount. What happens when you have banks this big is they really stop becoming community lenders and they become derivative trading firms. And as you may know, the derivatives are just out of hand. The top 10 banks in the United States have $200 trillion worth of open derivative positions. That's three times the world's GNP. It makes no sense, and we're all at risk for it. After the 1929 crash, everybody learned the right lessons. More disclosure, less leverage. Now we've gone the other way. There's no disclosure in the whole shadow banking hedge fund world, and there needs to be, and there's too much leverage everywhere in finance now.
Jim, I've been saying for a long time we need to cut up these banks into small enough pieces to where they can be digested, if need be, by the economy rather than killing the economy. And I think that we're paying a high price. We're being overcharged for the role of finance. We don't need that much finance in the economy for finance to serve as the lubricant for the engine of commerce rather than consuming commerce all for itself in what is essentially a non-productive role.
I couldn't say it better. I think you just said it just right. A few drops, good as a lubricant. Barrels ruin the machine.
Yeah, gunk up the works. This has been a fun book to read. It's been thought-provoking. Clearly, you've put a lot of thought into this, and just a pleasure to go through it. Five Easy Theses, Common Sense Solutions to America's Greatest Economic Challenges, by James Stone, our guest today, and I hope it starts some good discussions. It certainly got me thinking. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been a true pleasure.